Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. If you know the Atlanta hip-hop duo Outkast, the rappers Big Boi and Andre 3000, you might know him from that big pop smash, Hey Ya!
Thank God for mom and dad for sticking two together, cause we don't know how.
Or you might know him from their hit, The Way You Move.
But I know y'all wanted that 808, can you feel that B-A-S-S-A?
Regina Bradley wants you to pay attention to Outkast's deeper cuts and to think of them in a deeper way, as translators of the Black South in the post-Civil Rights era. Bradley teaches a class on Outkast at Kennesaw State University outside Atlanta, and she's got an upcoming book about the group called Chronicling Stankonia. That's a nod to the Outkast record from 2000 that's considered one of the great hip-hop records of all time. Bradley digs deep to place Outkast and the rest of Southern hip-hop in the broader context of the modern Black South, and how young rappers in particular have helped tell that story. Here's our conversation. I want to ask about Albany, Georgia, where you grew up, and as you know, has become one of the places in this country that's most hard hit by the coronavirus. I think last time I looked, per capita cases and deaths was like second most in the country. Has that affected you directly, friends and family, or what has it been like to see that from a distance?
It's kind of been surreal. My grandmother and my aunt still live in Albany. So it's kind of personal for me. I've lost people that I've known to the virus there. But yeah, it's kind of surreal though, because I'm kind of losing, on the one hand, I get it. Like, you know, I'm trying to do the social distancing thing because I'm trying to stay alive, you know what I'm saying? But the other part of it is that I usually feel like I'm the caretaker for my grandmother. So I can't go and check on her without fear of being asymptomatic, which is really just messing with me in a lot of interesting ways. But talking to friends and family who are down there, they're trying to do the social distancing thing, but it's also kind of fascinating to me and horrifying at the same time that from what they told me, there are people who are still walking around without masks on, who are acting like everything is all the norm. So it's irritating because the more that they don't follow the directions, you know, the longer I can't see my family. So I'm just like, just stay at home. One good time. A friend of mine lost her twin sister. And she had it on Facebook Live, and I don't know how to describe it. It was people were sitting in their cars while the immediate family was graveside. And you know, nobody mourns like Southerners, you know what I'm saying? It's a whole process. It's a whole thing. And not to be able to actually engage that, really hit home for me that the virus is really, really real.
Yeah. Cause it's not just the service. It's like the gathering beforehand, the visitation, and then everybody going to somebody's house afterward, and all the food, yeah, and all the, like, the fellowship and telling stories, all that's
going on. I mean, yeah, and fear of death. And then there are the folks who just don't care, who are like, we're going to get together regardless, which on the one hand I get, but on the other, I'm just like, this is what's keeping us so at risk, because in Albany, they say that one of the reasons it became a hot spot or an epicenter is because there was a funeral. So,
right, it started, you know, with a funeral. Even then
it started with death, you know what I'm saying? And but that doesn't, you know, it deters most folks, but to hear about folks like, I'm going to go to the funeral regardless. Like, I'm like, really? You're going to risk death to go and mourn death? Okay.
Yeah.
I just don't get it.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to your book for a little bit. Southern hip hop is sort of the dominant force in hip hop now. And there are lots of great artists that you could have chosen from. You know, Ludacris, Killer Mike, Rick Ross, Lil Wayne. There's just a huge list. Why?
Look at you, Tommy. No, I'm gonna
stipulate for the record that I'm not an expert, but I'm gonna do the best I can to keep up with you. Why of all the people you could have chosen, did you choose Outkast? Why did they matter?
Well, Outkast is such a pivotal part of me growing up in Albany. it was one of, you know, their music was one of my first real introductions to Southern hip hop. From even when I really didn't realize it was Outkast, like there was an episode of Martin where they were performing Players Ball, and I was just like, oh, okay. And then I moved to the South, and the music that I was listening to was coming out of New York because I was in Washington, D.C. So if it wasn't go-go, it was definitely New York hip hop. You know what I'm saying? And then I moved South, and then new friends and stuff were like, yeah, we don't really check for them like that. But on everybody's list was Outkast. So if I wanted to survive any kind of social death because I was starting high school, then I had to know who they were, and they just kind of stuck. Pretty much almost every major moment of my life, Outkast has been connected to it.
And you talk about the moment that I think about when I think about not just Outkast, but I think about sort of the Big Bang of Southern hip hop, which is that 1995 Source Awards.
Oh, yeah.
So could you explain for people who might not know what was going on then in the context, what happened then and why it was such a big deal?
At one point in hip hop, the Source magazine was the go-to. It was like, you know, some folks have called it the hip hop Bible. So like, you don't start the Source at the front of the magazine, you start at the end of the magazine because that's where they would rank the music that was coming out. And if you received the coveted 5 mics, that meant that they felt like your album was perfection. You know what I mean? But in addition to the mic system that they had in place, they also had an awards ceremony, usually during the summertime. So, you know, the 1995 Source Awards is really interesting because on the one hand, you have almost like the climax of this East Coast, West Coast beef that's going on between, or that's symbolized by, you know, Puff Daddy. Sean Combs was Puff Daddy at the time, so that's what we're going to call him. So Puff Daddy, Notorious B.I.G., you know, Bad Boy Records. And on the West Coast, you have Tupac Shakur and Suge Knight, right? And there was all of this going back and forth. There was a young Snoop Dogg who was like, oh, so the East Coast don't love us, you know what I'm saying? He was definitely in his feelings. And then you have this young group coming out of Atlanta who's up for best new rap group, best, you know. And you get there and Kid and Play and Salt and Pepper are the presenters, you know what I'm saying? And Outkast wins over Smith & Wesson, who was a, you know, kind of gangster rap group out of New York, and all hell breaks loose. And you have them trying to, you know, accept their award and be like, you know, we appreciate it. And you have folks like Big Boi who are like trying to be diplomatic. But then as he passes the mic on to Dre, he's like, so what's up? Which is Southernese for, you know, talk what you got to say. And Andre comes out. He's clearly frustrated. He's clearly over it. And he's like, you know.
But it's like this, though. I'm tired of folks, you know what I'm saying? Closed-minded folks, you know what I'm saying? It's like we got a demo tape and don't nobody want to hear it, but it's like this, the South got something to say. That's all I got to say.
And, you know, he gives a rallying cry, which in Chronicling Sanconia, I'm like you said, I mean, I think that's a really great way to put it, is the Big Bang. It's like, oh, so we can do this hip-hop stuff. We can do this on our own. We don't have to emulate what's coming out of the East Coast or out of the West Coast. We can do our own thing. And that's why Outkast is so pivotal to how we understand why hip-hop exploded the way it did.
You sum it up in a really cool way in the book, in a way that I never thought about. You call them the founding theoreticians of the hip hop South. Could you dig into that a little bit more and explain what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, when I talk about like the founding theoreticians, like they took this idea of Southern hip hop and they experimented with what Southernness could be, where it was going, how it manifested, how you could perform it. And you know, this is something that I teach in my Outkast class, and hopefully I do this in the book also, is to kind of show the evolution of how their thinking about the South is reflected in the evolution of their music, whether it's, you know, sonically, if you're looking at, the first album, Southern Playalistic, Cadillac Music, you know, you hear the influence of gospel and blues and funk in particular, because of connections to, you know, Organized Noize and in Atlanta as a funk capital. You know what I'm saying? Before you had hip hop there, you had funk, you had SOS Band, you had Cameo, Gap. You know what I'm saying? Folks were coming to Atlanta to record and make this really great music. But as they, you know, grew as men, as they grew as artists, you can kind of hear the evolution of that in how they present their ideas of Southerness. You know what I mean? And I think it comes to a climax in Stankonia, which is they produced the majority of it. Organized Noise had a couple of songs on there, but you could definitely hear the difference in terms of what was influencing the music, how they were thinking about themselves, how they were thinking about their success. And that was reflected in that. So, you know, a theoretician is somebody who puts something into practice and experiments with it and fails with it and everything like that. So that's why I was like, OutKast definitely fits the bill for thinking about Southern hip hop as a theorization of what the South looks like after the Civil Rights Movement.
And the after the Civil Rights Movement, I think, is key to what you talk about in the book, because, and correct me if I'm wrong here or expound on this, your sort of theory is that by listening to OutKast, you can sort of hear the evolution or the sort of the current thinking amongst a lot of the Black South in what the post-Civil Rights Movement is like.
So when we think about the Black South, we get restricted to the Civil Rights Movement as the apex of modernity for Southern Black people. And as somebody who wasn't around, not even a thought, is important for folks like me who are like, okay, where does the South go after the movement? Because that seems to be restrictive in some ways, because nobody wants to say that what happens in the South triumphs what happened during the movement. But what Southern hip hop does is it recognizes the strides that have been done in, you know, during the movement, from borrowing, from sampling, to referencing, you know, leadership from MLK to, you know, Ralph David Abernathy, you know, folks like that, Andrew Young, and saying, well, there are still things and still issues and concerns that have not been addressed. And this is how we're going to do it. We're going to use the music to reflect on that. But it's just really interesting to think about how the South has moved, not necessarily moved on, but has made strides towards being considered a contemporary space, using hip hop as a means to do that.
And can you point out or sort of highlight a track or two that people might want to go back and listen to that sort of kind of exemplify what you're talking about?
I mean, yeah, you could go album by album. but if we're starting at the beginning, if you listen to Southern Playalistic in particular, Get Up and Get Out.
You need to get up, get out, and get something. Don't let the days of your life pass by. You need to get up, get out, and get something. Don't spend all your time trying to get high.
Right, like they're talking about voting. They're talking about what happens if, you know, my vote doesn't really change anything. What happens if education isn't the means to success? Which, you know, for folks like myself, my grandparents were raised in the Jim Crow South. You know, my grandmother's from South Georgia. She's from Leary. My grandfather is from Northern Georgia, from Athens. You know, education was always the gatekeeper of success, and Get Up, Get Out is one of those songs that's like, okay, well, what happens if it doesn't work for me, right? It brings in questions of social economic conditioning, that, you know, education isn't a free all be all for everybody.
As you were talking about all this and as I was reading your book and sort of diving into this in a deep way, it made me wonder what Andre and Big Boy think about how they're perceived in the wider, I don't mean white, W-H-I-T-E, although I guess that may be true as well. I think if you ask people about OutKast, they're known for Hey Ya,
right,
and for I Like the Way You Move,
yep,
like sort of the hit records that people dance to or played on YouTube a lot or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how they feel about be known for that and not as much for this much richer, deeper kind of intellectual stuff that you're talking about.
I mean, like from what I've read from the interviews I did read, it was like, you know, they gave you the standard pageant speech, right? Like, you know, it's an honor to be studied and to think about these things. But I also, you know, think it's on the part of those of us who write about the music, like, you know, like myself, to connect the dots for folks, you know, like, you know, I don't think it's fair to have somebody to produce the work and then have to contextualize the work and then have to break it down in ways that, you know, folks like academics can do. And I think what I hope that Chronicling Stankonia does is introduces folks to the possibility of how that kind of rich analysis exists below the Mason-Dixon line. Like that's been, I feel like that's been my rallying cry from pretty much my entire academic career, is in ways that Andre was like, the South got something to say. I feel like with my scholarship and the scholarship of other folks who are writing about the South, like Zandria Robinson, for example, is we're showing, yeah, the South got some, still got something to say, and this is how they're saying it. This is how you need to context it. Thinking about outcasts outside of what mainstream appreciates them for and recognizes them for pushes folks to really consider, okay, there's much more complicated, wonderful things that are happening in Southern, in contemporary Southern Black culture. Let's give it a serious read, which is what I try to do for some of the other topics that I tackle in the book as well.
When we come back, Regina Bradley talks about how the rapper T.I., known for his trap music, helped her get over her father's unexpected death. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I'd like to take just a moment here to remind you of the remarkable work my colleagues at WFAE have done in one of the most trying times I can remember as a journalist. From Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, to our daily newscasts, to our stories on the web, our staff has worked long and hard to bring you news about the coronavirus and, more recently, the protests locally and globally after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. You can find all our work, news, features, podcasts, anytime at WFAE.org, where you can also make a donation in any amount to support it. Just hit the donate button on WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. Thanks for supporting local journalism and Southern stories. And now, back to our conversation with Regina Bradley. One of the things that struck me as I was reading and listening to Outkast, as I was reading along, is, you know, you talk about this the two-ness that W.B. Du Bois talked about that every Black person has to deal with, the sort of the way they present themselves in one world is the way they present themselves in another, what I think might be referred to now as code switching or that sort of thing. I also see this two-ness in Outkast, although maybe not quite the same way, and I'm oversimplifying here, but I always thought of like Big Boy as sort of the party guy and Andre as sort of the intellectual.
I mean, I think that's part of it. I think they're, you know, I agree with the idea that it's two sides of the same coin, you know what I'm saying? But I also think that, you know, when we have these conversations about what distinguishes a Big Boy from Andre, I think that one of the reasons that we are immediately drawn to Andre is that he's not accessible. Like, we hear from him, you know, he drops 16 bars, it seems like, you know, every other year, which in dog years seems forever, you know what I'm saying? And then he gives us this wonderful insight, and then we're just like, oh, we need it, and he disappears again, you know what I'm saying? And I think that's that the mystique around him is something that stands out. I think the other part of it that stands out in terms of how Andre is different is Andre is more visceral in how we respond to him. Like, he pulls on emotions, he pulls on experiences that might mirror our own in ways that Big Boy does the same thing, but because he's more known as the, I feel like he's the grounding force in Outkast, because if you didn't have Big Boy, you wouldn't be able to get the experimental Andre that everybody kind of fell in love with. You know what I'm saying?
Right. It feels like that they're very different, but they're like essential to each other.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know, Aquemini says that the song, the title, you know, you can't have one without the other. And I think what's interesting is that we don't give Big Boy all of his flowers, so to speak, because he's been accessible. He's around. He uses social media. Like, you know, he says he's in Oregon when football season is in, he's in Oregon watching his son play, or he's in New York checking on his other son, or like we have access to his life in ways that we don't have access to Andre's life.
One of the things you talk about that I really, that's been fascinating to me on a lot of levels for years now is, the way you phrase it is, that one of the things Outkast talks about is that the South is not a place that's in need of escaping. And obviously through history, you know, up until, you know, up through the slavery days, Jim Crow days, the Great Migration days, the South was always thought of a place where if you're Black, you needed to get away from. And now that's changing. And I'm wondering how you see that, not only in your life, but through this music that you're analyzing.
I mean, from a personal level, you know, I kind of re-migrated to the South at 14, you know, you know, like I was part of that group that would come down every summer and come and see my Southern family and get tore up by the mosquitoes and have to go and explain the scars from all the scratching when I got back, you know, stuff like that. And then I moved permanently to the South in 1998 and I was about to start high school. And I'm part of that re-migration narrative that people are talking about, right? But I think too, what's important is that if we think about the historical context of a lot of the major exoduses from the South, whether it's the Great Migration of the early 20th century, if we're talking about, you know, escaping from enslavement in the, you know, antebellum era, right? One of the things that gets overlooked in favor of, you know, villainizing the South, which is ultimately what happens, because that's comfortable for people, you know what I'm saying? If something goes bad, we're going to blame the South. I mean, like, even today, you see folks who, oh, well, it's the South's fault, you know? And I'm like, wait, what? This wasn't just the South that was voting. But, you know, we don't complicate the South. And I think that's what the biggest challenge is, Tommy, is like, we need to find ways to complicate the South because it's so much easier to be like, there's one South, there's one universal Southern experience. And if you don't adhere to that Southern experience, then, you know, are you really Southern? You know what I'm saying? And with the remigration South, especially for Black folks, you know what I mean? Like for a lot of folks, to borrow from, you know, Charlie Braxton, it's like folks are just coming back home. You know what I'm saying? The population in the American South for African American folks, Black folks, you know what I'm saying, is significant. And I think that what Outkast does is like, yeah, let's tell the story of those of us who didn't leave the South. So I mean, like, you can put Outkast in conversation with somebody like Isabel Wilkerson, right, in The Warmth of Other Suns, where she's like, I'm going to document the stories of the folks who took part of their South with them and ended up in these different urban spots around the country, from Los Angeles to Chicago to Detroit. And Outkast is like, well, what about those of us who didn't leave the South, who didn't want to leave the South, right? So like somebody like my grandparents, for example, my grandfather was in Athens and he moved to Albany. And he got a job in Albany and he raised a family in Albany, you know what I mean? But we don't necessarily hear about those stories. We hear about the folks who wanted to escape.
You know, it's funny you talk about how we need to complicate the South for people from outside, because it feels to me like anybody who lives here, it's incredibly complicated. You know, as a white Southerner, I can't possibly feel it in the same way that a Black Southerner does. To live in a place that has, to put it mildly, not always loved you back.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, and it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, is like, you know, it's much more complicated than that. And I try to talk about that in the book too. I'm like, you know, just because you see folks in tandem doesn't mean that their relationships to what they're living and experiencing are the exact same thing. Like, I just, there's some things that happen with Southern white experiences. I'm like, I don't know nothing about that.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm okay with saying I don't know anything, you know, anything about that, right? One of the challenges in recognizing and letting the complexities of the South breathe is that we try to use a universal model to explain what that Southernness is. So like, for example, if we're talking about Jesmyn Ward, and folks are talking about whether it's, you know, Men We Reaped or Sing Unbury Sing most recently, because that got her second National Book Award, you know what I'm saying? You know, folks like, oh, we can use William Faulkner to contextualize Jesmyn Ward. And I'm like, no, not really. that doesn't fit. It's two different time periods. One, so even though the South always is reaching backwards while trying to move forward, and that's something that I try to talk about in the book also, is that, you know, the South always has one foot in the past, one foot in the future. We don't necessarily have good footing in the present.
Are the students who are coming into your classes, like if you're teaching on OutKast, will most of them already be really familiar? Will some of them be kids who just come in to learn about it? Like, what's the mix? What's it like in the classroom?
So I have taught it four times. We'll taught the OutKast class four times. And the second time I taught it, I had nothing but OutKast aficionados in the class. It was pretty awesome. So it was like, I didn't really have to explain things the way that I would in a class of students who aren't as familiar, which happened this past semester. But nonetheless, it was still a great experience because I got to introduce folks to my favorite group of all time and why they're important. But being able to connect how they're in conversation with some of the students' interests. So I had one student who connected the Stankonia album to, you know, what heavy metal coming out of the South sounds like. And I was like, oh, that's dope.
I want to ask about another story that you tell in your book about basically how I'm oversimplifying this, but how T.I. helped you get through your father's death.
Okay.
And first of all, explain T.I. for those who might not know, and then maybe tell a little bit about that story about how he helped you get through that tough moment.
So, you know, T.I. is one of the pioneer rappers for trap rap. As it's called now. I mean, like, trap is kind of all over the world. It's international now. But at one point in time, it was, when I say restricted, but it was more celebrated in the South.
And maybe real quick, explain trap real quick.
Yeah, so trap music is a, you know, initially for me, it started as a subgenre of Southern hip hop where it was talking about drug dealing and drug culture as it related in the South. And the one thing that distinguishes, you know, that drug narrative that you hear in trap from something like, you know, the corner boy narrative that you would hear in New York is the beat, right? Is the background accompaniment. So, I mean, like the use of synthesizers, you know, the really dark, gritty hi-hats, you know what I'm saying? 808 bass kicks, stuff like that. But my father unexpectedly died in a tree cutting accident December 21st, 2004, which is, you know, kind of hard on all ends because it's 4 days before Christmas and, you know, all that whole, it's the holiday season. It was unexpected. But my boyfriend at the time, now husband, came from work. He got off work and he came and he kind of just sat with me before he went back to work. He left me his T.I. Urban Legend CD, which really helped me to kind of get through the hardest time of my life. And in case you forgot, I'm a kid. Got back close with my dad, and then by the time we finally got our relationship back on track, you know, he was gone. So,
and to this day, when you hear that music, or do you, if you still listen to it, does it still have that same power to bring back those memories?
Yeah, it does actually. I still listen to Urban Legend, you know, every once in a while. Not every once in a while. I feel like I listen to Urban Legend at least two or three times a month. Still, it seems like. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's not as painful listening to the music as it was, you know, back when I was 20 in 2004, but I mean, it's still, it kind of is a sonic reminder, sonic, memorial, if you will, for my dad, and how music kind of connected us together, even in death. So
it's amazing to me how music has that power. And I think it's because of the beat, not necessarily just hip hop, just any beat, and the way that it's constructed to be memorable, right? Yeah. And that songs can stick with you, you know, long after everything else is gone. The snippet from a song can make all the difference. It can raise up this emotion that you don't even expect coming sometimes. That's, I think, part of what's really interesting about what you're doing, to sort of dig into the intellectual part of it, because the emotional part's already there. and to kind of figure out what's underneath all that is really fascinating to me. I want to just wrap up real quick by kind of circling back to this Source Award moment where Andre says, you know, the South's got something to say. You begin your book by sort of you kind of put the acknowledgments in the beginning in some ways, and you list off, I don't know, probably 100 scholars, you know, friends, people who've inspired you, family members. It might be the longest acknowledgments I've ever read, which is not a criticism, by the way. All that, and whether maybe your credo or whatever is that same thing that he said, that as Southerners, everybody in that group has something to say, and that it's worth listening to.
I mean, yeah, I think that's the best way to put it. I always laugh at the acknowledgments because it's such a hard thing to write. It's harder than writing the book because if you forget somebody, because, you know, nobody's petty like a Southerner. You know what I'm saying? It's like, there's no petty like Southern petty. And I know you know what I'm talking about because you laugh. It's like and I'm still terrified at that acknowledgments because I know that, you know, especially when the older folks in my family read it, if I forgot an auntie or an uncle, I know I'm not going to hear the end of it. You know what I'm saying? But I think that one of the reasons that my acknowledgments is so long is that so many folks influenced how I think about the South. And I wanted to make sure that I paid homage to that. You know what I mean? But I also think it speaks to something that I always carry around with me as a Southerner is that community comes first. You know what I mean? And community, both in the academy and just, you know, being from Albany, has helped me to think through some of the things that I theorize in the book. It helped me theorize about, you know, what I want to do with the work that I'm currently doing. So it only felt right for me to make sure that I acknowledge where I came from. And also to you know, riff off of what Andre said, the South still got something to say. You know what I mean? I wanted to show you that it's not just me talking about it. There's a whole lot of other folks talking about Southerners too.
Here's a little postscript of this podcast. We recorded this conversation before the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis and the massive nationwide protests since then about police brutality and black empowerment. So I reached out to Regina Bradley and asked if she had anything she wanted to say. She emailed me with this, and I'm quoting her now. I recorded this conversation with Tommy weeks prior to the senseless murder, yes, murder, of George Floyd and the subsequent uprisings taking place around the world. I want to dedicate this conversation to his memory and that of Breonna Taylor, Nina Pop, and Tony McDade. May my work stand as a testament to how and why all Black lives matter. End quote. I'll just add if you don't know the names. Breonna Taylor was shot to death by Louisville police back in March after they knocked down her door looking for somebody else. And Nina Pop and Tony McDade were Black trans people who were killed in recent weeks. McDade was shot to death by police in Tallahassee, Florida in May. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.